Hello and welcome to this special series from Great British Brands in association with Changemakers, a collection of conversations with outstanding guests where we seek the answer to a very big question: what next? In the course of answering this, we explore what it takes to be a great British brand and the people and stories behind them. Now, my guest today is the founder of Darjeeling Express, the chef, restaurateur and author Asma Khan. And she's been described in the Evening Standard as a force of nature, bold, funny, talented, philanthropic and unstoppable. And it all began as a private supper club career for friends, and it would lead to critical acclaim and become the hottest ticket in town, taking Soho by storm and receiving attention from around the world. In 2019, she became the first British chef to feature on Netflix's Emmy Award-winning series Chef's Table. And with accolades such as Business Insider's coolest person in food and drink, this is one express that is very much on track. Asma, welcome. Let's start with bold, funny, talented, philanthropic and unstoppable.
That's such a wonderful line of things to read when with connected to you. That's very kind. I think that this is just, you know, my way of trying to leave a mark, because, you know, I'm not willing to let my life go. I see every day as a gift, and, you know, I'm not willing to die till I know that I left a ripple big enough, that I left a legacy, because I hope that I will see women, you know, surpassing me in my profession, because I'm very conscious of the fact that I was the first of a lot of things, you know, an all-female kitchen, you know, and also being on Netflix, and in my own family connection, you know, setting up a business this way, very unusual. But I want to see this as, I see a greater story beyond myself. And I guess that's what, you know, people pick up when they see me or talk to me.
Yeah, having, you know, spent some time reading your story, I mean, the sense of positivity and optimism just exudes in the story, in the telling of the story. And I suppose we see it together today through your business, Darjeeling Express, and we'll get on to the business in a moment. But of course, you came to the UK in 1991 from Calcutta. And I'm thinking, you know, what does the newly arrived Asma think in terms of what's coming next? I mean, had you got any sense of the story that was about to unfold?
Not at all. And the thing is that it's quite hard now to visualize what the world was like 30 years ago. Now, if you miss home, you can WhatsApp your dog in Delhi and have a chat with your dog. But when I left India, it was very, very expensive to travel. I knew I would not go home for a while. It was very expensive to call. There were no mobile phones. My parents didn't have computers. I didn't have a computer. So you couldn't communicate with anyone. So it was, in some ways, exile. It was leaving forever. And I got that sense. And also there was some level of fear because I was coming to this country to move in with a stranger. I had an arranged marriage. I met my husband twice before I moved. And so it was all of this, you know, so there were lots of kind of, you know, challenges and fears in my head, but also a lot of excitement, you know, because I finally, you know, got married, which was something I really wanted to be married for a long time. Very Asian thing, you know, that, you know, all your friends and cousins got married, you know, you were past 18 or 19 years old and you hadn't got married. So all those pressures, I felt relieved that I'd found a suitable boy.
Well, I mean, I'm going to keep us on the then rather than the next at the moment, because I'm thinking back to 91. So you've had an arranged marriage, you've come to a new country, and I'm thinking about brand Britain then. When you arrived, what was your expectation in terms of the great British brand of 1991 and what you actually found?
I have to say, I was quite disappointed. I came in January to Cambridge, and I was told there was a river. I come from Bengal, but the rivers are like oceans. And I saw this little trickle that had frozen, which was a river Cam. And then the other shock for me was the fact I'd never seen trees without leaves. It's tropical, you know, it's Bay of Bengal. It's like a sauna. But in some ways, it was also very hard because I remember running my hand down the bark of the tree and feeling that tree was stripped of everything beautiful and soft. And I felt like that tree. I didn't think the tree would ever have a spring. I didn't think I would ever have a spring. It was the kind of winter that, you know, I told my father this when I wrote a letter to him, that in the Quran, they got it wrong. It is not boiling oil and fire. It is Cambridge in winter with the cutting cold wind that cuts through your silk clothes. I came without winter clothes. I came with all my bridal wear.
Well, so I suppose it was. I bet you got down to a great British brand to buy some good woolies straight after that. But I mean, let's fast forward it to 2020, and I mean, you know, that story from a kind of visit to a cold Cambridge is transformed into the red hot story of Darjeeling Express, a wonderful restaurateur reputation as being the place to go. Tell us about the Britain of today in terms of how you see the British brand and from the context of your own business.
I think it has changed. In the 30 years that I've been here, I have watched it change. And I, you know, I don't feel, you know, I do have a British passport. I don't feel British, but I definitely feel like a Londoner. London is my identity. And, you know, I belong to the city. City belongs to me. I think that I could not have set up this kind of restaurant, an all-female restaurant, without any chefs who are professionally trained. They don't exist in the East. They don't have them in Calcutta. You can only do this in London. I feel a strong sense of identity with the city.
Right, so strong sense. Okay, so if you feel that identity with the city, with London, let's think about some of the values then, the brand, if you like, that you buy into about the city that you live and work within.
So I think the real thing is that I think the open-heartedness and the fact that in London you can be anything you want to be. And I think this is also true for large parts of Britain as well. I think there is a level there, if you really want it, you can make it in this country. And I say this as an immigrant, as a Muslim, as a woman who started a business in the late 40s. I think there has to be passion and desire. People will notice you in this country if you're good. You don't need to shout it from the rooftops. There is a lot of people over here who, thanks to social media as well, and, you know, regular media, who will pick on the stories, who recognize someone who's different. And also, it's not just my accented voice where you can hear that I'm from the East and the West. There are many people like me. But I think that we tell the stories of two different cultures. And in London, you can be everything and anything you want to be.
So you found a home for that authentic fusion, the bringing together of ideas and cultures. I mean, tell us about the restaurant today, in terms of how that finds its manifestation, if you will, in terms of what you actually find when you go through the doors at Darjeeling Express.
Well, the first thing you will notice is diversity. And that's true of almost every restaurant in London and in large parts of Britain as well. You know, the work, everybody who works on the floor in the front of house, it comes from very interesting, different backgrounds. You know, the diversity includes sexuality, ethnicity, gender. So we have kind of a real mix of people. Then interestingly, there are a lot of women in this business. You notice that when you come in, you know, front of house as well. We do have men, we pay them the same. We treat them with a lot of respect. We don't bully them. And we make sure the men also get promoted if they're good. So we are very fair to the men who work for us. So, but yes, it is pretty much dominated by a lot of women around. And, so that's what you will first notice.
So there's femininity in this business. There's a female leadership and a female culture that's driving this.
Yes, yes. But there are men who work here as well. And I hope that they don't feel, suppressed by so many women around. Because I know that that's, you know, women working in very male-dominated restaurants, their story is very different. So I'm very conscious of that because I speak a lot about bullying and, you know, discrimination in restaurants, in restaurant kitchens. I must make sure that the men who work for me are equally protected. But you will notice it's a female-owned business. You know that the moment you enter through the doors, there's a difference.
And in terms of the guest experience, in terms of what that delivers that makes it different, how would you capture that? apart from just what you see?
I think that a lot of people continue to come to my restaurants who came to my home supper club, because that's where I started, in my own dining room. And almost everyone says, we feel we ate at your home. That is really the kind of feeling you get eating at my restaurant. That really kind of made me quite emotional, the first guest who said it, in Covent Garden, because we are now in a flagship, you know, restaurant, you know, huge, great two-listed building, enormous space. But we were able to recreate that same intimacy, warmth, in a much larger space. This was not
just... So it's a home.
Yes. And I think that, you know, I do feel for all of us, this is home. This is an oasis. This is where we felt we belonged, all of us. All of us feel this connection to this land because of the restaurant. Because it wasn't the fact that we all, like, you know, my children used to be most embarrassed when, you know, other people would ask me before I had the restaurant, that, do you have family in this country? And I would say no. And my son would nudge me and say, what am I? Aren't I your family? But somehow even having children in this country didn't feel make me connected to the soil of this country, having a business.
And if you were to think about a great British brand today, if you were to define that for us, what would be the constituent parts in your mind in terms of that identity, that reputation?
I think heritage is very important in any for a British brand to be what it is. Because this is a land with stories and a depth, and, you know, I think that is very important. So for me, a British brand has to be one that has heritage, a story, something distinctive, but also something that is open-hearted, open-minded, that it reflects, you know, change and adapts to changing circumstances. So for me, Britain is always been a country that has seen waves of change, you know, historically, people coming and leaving, and of course, you know, immigration and all of that, and has absorbed us all, and you know, we've all thrived in this land. And I think for me, a British brand is one that can actually absorb change and transform into something relevant for the times.
And in terms of absorbing that change, I mean, obviously thinking about the next chapter, what comes next is there are a lot of big items on the to-do list, Brexit and, you know, getting the other side of COVID. When you sort of look at the future of the British brand, how confident do you feel about it?
I'm very confident because I think that, you know, the adaptability and, you know, it is not done with huge song and dance. It is very subtle. You know, it is like a meandering river. It slowly will get to the ocean eventually. And I think British brands are like that. You know, I think that a really good brand will always find its way out of every difficulty, you know, find a way around the rock and the boulders and keep moving forward.
A very good friend of mine, when I was in my early 20s, he was from Lahore. And I always remember that his family would have a lot of people round for dinner. And there was a very strong sense of the matriarchy within there, was that actually all centered around the kitchen, the cooking, yeah, the companionship, the coming together. I mean, is that the supper club you created when you started? Do you identify with that?
Absolutely. The thing is that I felt bereft leaving home. And cooking was my way home. But it wasn't that I had to cook for myself. I needed to watch other people eat the food I cooked. And this is why I started the supper clubs, because I wanted to serve. I wanted to feed. I wanted to heal. And this goes down in my DNA. This is part of South Asian culture. So Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, this whole thing of feeding. People, you walk into the house and people say, what can I give you to eat? They won't even ask you, hello, how are you? The whole first thing is, what can I feed you? Because feeding is a way of showing love. It's also a way of communicating in my culture. And that is what I got through my supper clubs. And even today, I feed. So the food is a bridge between me and that person.
And I suppose also, I mean, you are part of one of the very greatest institutions in this country, which is the Authentic Indian Restaurant. I think the very first one was 1809, I was reading, in terms of the tradition, I guess, in terms of your part within it, in terms of where you see this going, because you're part of this new generation of restaurants that feel that they've gone beyond what was almost expected, to actually recreate, deconstruct, think again about the experience. Tell us a little bit about your take on it and how you've taken on the tradition.
Well, the thing is that, you know, I do hear a lot of chefs today, a lot of young chefs as well, criticizing the corner shop, the curry houses on the high street. And I don't criticize them because I know they changed the palate of a nation. They came in. We have first advantage over all the Peruvian food, Japanese food, every other cuisine that has come after us. There is something magical about Indian food for British people because we were here first. And that is a huge advantage. I stand on the shoulders of the curry houses. I am grateful to them. Yes, their food is not what I would recognize. Yes, their food is a bit unusual, a lot of it made up, but that's okay. Because the thing is that, you know, England and Britain in the 60s and 70s was a very difficult place. They came in, they faced a lot of racism, they built up businesses, they didn't go and, you know, get handouts. They employed all their families, you know, not all of them very skilled at cooking, but they did something. And, you know, they faced a lot of hostility. And I think that they're not praised enough.
But also brilliant entrepreneurs, not only facing social difficulties, but also building businesses that people will spend money within, spend their time within. I mean, there is an entrepreneurial tradition there also, I think.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I look very different, my food looks very different, I'm not very different from them. And I'm not ashamed to be associated with the old curry houses, because I think that, you know, we all are doing similar things. It's just that what I'm offering is very different. I'm offering a kind of more authentic experience to what you would find in a home in India.
Yeah, but you're also bringing more women into the kitchen. I think this is the thing in terms of your experiences. I think about the philanthropy, the things you're involved with outside of the business. Before the pandemic, you were offering your kitchens on Sundays to aspiring chefs to host supper clubs. You support a charity, the Second Daughters Fund, fundraising for female ISIS survivors. I mean, in terms of actually the role of women as you have campaigned for it, let's talk a little bit about that also and actually how that manifests itself in your business.
Yes, for me, it's really important because I think that we are, our whole lives, we have been dismissed. We're hiding behind walls and we have never been celebrated or recognized for the contribution that we've made. We are the healers, we are the feeders, we're the custodians of recipes. And I just want the role of women to be recognized. And I felt that, you know, very conscious of being quite alone on a stage when it comes to hospitality. When I stood on the stage and the spotlight hit me with Netflix, all I saw in front of me in the dark audience was women who would never get on stage. That was very, very humbling because I realized I am the face of every woman who was sidelined. I'm the face of every woman who didn't get promoted, who wasn't paid the same as her male colleagues, who was made to feel she was not celebrated. I'm the face of every girl, every second daughter whose birth was lamented, who was made to feel that they were not wanted. And I needed to talk about this because I need to speak for those who cannot speak. And that is why I don't see this as separate from my business or even separate from me, because I am this. I am very conscious in myself. I see every woman who felt she could not make it. And I want every woman to look at me and think, irrespective of color of your skin, who you are, to know that in your late 40s, in our culture, seen as the autumn of our lives, this is the spring of my life. And, you know, do not allow society, you know, to categorize you by your dress size, your bank balance, the car you drive. You are more than that. You're greater than that.
This sense of the inner spirit, the inner personality, I mean, I think that's exuding through this interview. But presumably 2020 has been a year where you've had to dig deep in terms of being a frontline business, a restaurant business, facing the pandemic and everything that goes with that in terms of lockdowns, the closing downs. I mean, tell us a little bit about the resilience that you've had to Well, have you had to build it, or was it naturally there? You'll tell us.
The thing is that, you know, I said this at when I was interviewed for Chef's Table, that you don't know how your ability to fly, the strength of your wings, till you jump off the cliff. And I again faced that point with 2020. I closed my restaurant a week before lockdown because I realized that while this government dithered and was unable to get its act together, I wasn't going to put my staff at risk or my customers.
Can you tell us how that felt? I could imagine it must have been an enormously emotional moment when you realized you had no other choice but to shut the doors.
Yes, and of course, you know, I shut my doors before furlough was announced, before any kind of support system was announced by the government. I told 25 staff, I will pay for everything. I will look after your families. I will pay you your wages. But I want you to go home because I want you to live. I want you to be safe.
But this is you as the protector, Asma. But I'm thinking about you. What was going on in your mind in terms of what you were thinking? Was it, did you feel just strong and I can deal with this? Did you feel panic? Did you feel fear? Did you feel hope? Tell us a little bit about the emotional experience of that very first lockdown.
I actually, ironically, felt very powerful. I realized that I was taking a decision for which I would be proud later on. It was a tough decision. I knew that when I said that, that was the end of all my savings. And also my little dream that I had, because, you know, I come from a conservative Muslim family. I was never allowed to do anything on my own. And, you know, then I got married, never had a chance. I'd saved money to go after I turned 50 on a solo bike ride on a Royal Enfield Bullet, a vintage British bike around Europe on my own. I don't know how to ride a motorcycle, but I was going to learn. I'd saved money for that. And that was the first thing I realized, that that's the end of that dream. But I'll put all this money in. So I'd saved money.
See, that gave you fortitude, did it?
Yes. And I knew that I had saved the money. I had the money. And also one of the things, you know, and this probably comes from the fact that, you know, my father comes from a very ancient warrior tribe. I saw this as a battle. And I saw that if I do not lead from the front, and if I'm not there for everybody, if I'm not the protector, then I don't have a right to have a business, because these people are putting their labor into a business. If they are to come back, they must come back knowing that I am there for them.
And I suppose a lot of people listening to this would identify with 2020 as a battle, especially those running businesses. And of course, restaurants have been through very particular phases of that battle. Closed down in the spring, reopened over the summer, closed down again. In terms of what you've learned about yourself, let's bring it right up to date in terms of where we are now. What would you take out of it in terms of starting to think about the what comes next?
Well, the one thing that I always felt suspected, but I was not sure of, is that a lot of self-selection happens in hospitality. This became very evident with the way that a lot of male chefs and restaurant owners reacted with their staff. When a lot of them could follow them, you heard stories about people who were in hospitality sleeping rough in Trafalgar Square. You had chefs with considerable personal fortune who decided to sack their staff. And that really made me understand, we don't have the right to have the word hospitality. We are not hospitable. We don't have the right to say that we provide service. We do not. Because we did not show responsibility towards our own teams. And so one thing that, you know, and I know I did. It's not that I'm arrogant or proud of myself, but I know I did it, and I know others could have done it too.
So doing the right thing.
Yes. I think that we need to do the right thing. I think that, you know, there's a squeeze. I know the bottom line is important for some people, and margins are very thin in restaurants. You could see by the fact the great and the good and the mediocre all fell apart when, you know, during lockdown, that they couldn't sustain it. But this has meant that a lot of the crushing pressure has been on staff, with the kinds of hours they're being asked to do, the wages that they get, the environment in which they work. And I think that this entire pandemic has just confirmed to me that, you know, slavery is not dead in some industries, because when you expect someone to put in their heart and soul, but you throw them overboard when things get tough, it says something terrible about the leaders of our industry. And I think that really it's time, you know, for change to happen. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you need to have more women. There are a lot of very empathetic men in hospitality. I could give you a long list of men who I really admire, who've shown huge leadership and compassion and empathy to their teams. So it's not a male and female thing. And I've also seen a lot of female, many of them Michelin star female chefs, who've always kept quiet when it's come, you know, when you talk about bullying in kitchens.
And so I suppose this is the balance sheet, if you like, in terms of what you've observed, both in terms of your own character and the character of those around you, which I suppose brings us on to the big question about, well, what's next? Some people say this will be the reset. We'll do things differently. Things will be kinder, gentler, more in balance. Others will say, don't believe a word of it. We've heard all of this before. When you look at the next stage, you know, obviously we've got things like a vaccine in play. There is hope on the horizon in terms of a way out of the pandemic. When you think about what that means for you as a restaurateur and chef, business owner, as a brand creator, give us your sense of where it's all going and your hopes and fears for that future.
Well, let me talk about the hopes first. I hope that people who have had this long time away from restaurants and hospitality will probably, I hope, will come back and appreciate our efforts more. You often hear people that, oh, you know, this is all overpriced. And, you know, they don't factor in labor. They just look at the cost of ingredients, that, you know, this was a bit too expensive. But I think that I also hope that, you know, the time, you know, maybe we've all forgotten that period where you couldn't get flour and you couldn't get eggs. And God, heaven forbid, you couldn't get toilet paper. And people were fighting in the aisles for that. I think it's so important that people buy more local. I don't fly down any ingredients from India. I don't do okra and jackfruit in my restaurant. Never done it. Most of my produce is British. I buy everything British. I buy local as much as I can. My beetroot that makes my iconic classic household beetroot chop comes from the Fens in Cambridge. So it is really important that, you know, I've seen this, that people had to kind of, you know, buy from the farmers, you know, people went to the local markets. I hope that these are all the positive things that have happened. The negative thing is that I'm afraid that people are going to come back and go into battle zone again. And I've heard this from a lot of people who lost their jobs. The mothers lost their jobs first. Women lost their jobs first. Female sommeliers were removed. Because now when people come back into full business, they're going to look at it like, you know, we need to really crack on with it. This is not Mortal Kombat. You are not going into war. And too many women have lost their jobs in hospitality. I don't think they're going to come back.
But I suppose, I mean, to take the warrior tribe idea, that the battle does continue, though, in terms of that future and what you fight for. I suppose my final question then, in terms of, well, what's next for Darjeeling Express? What's next for Asma? And in terms of this next phase coming out of something huge and enormous?
I think I see myself, before I see myself anything, I see myself as an activist and, you know, as a disruptor. I will always be the one, you know, heckling on the sides. I won't let things pass. I will always call it out, racism, misogyny. And I'm unafraid. Because I'm an outsider, I'm on the fringe of hospitality. I don't owe anyone anything. So in this way, I'm liberated. By being so different from everybody else, it's so liberating. I can say anything I want. And, you know, not in a kind of rude and aggressive way. I say it with great honor and respect. But I don't feel this club of hospitality, that I don't belong to this club. I don't want to belong to this club when the club looks like this. And so I think my future is really trying to make change by constantly talking about it, by being part of it, but not part of it. In some ways, the outsider, always the renegade, but it allows me the freedom to speak out.
Well, I have to say, Asma, what a wonderful place to leave it, because I think the freedom to speak out is such an integral part of being a change maker. And I'm just thinking how lucky we are that that cold winter's day in Cambridge didn't actually put you off building your future in London and building Darjeeling Express. And thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Changemakers X with Great British Brands. And it's been that story of the unstoppable express train reigniting the great British passion for Indian food and providing a platform for aspiring entrepreneurs to be the next great innovators of the British culinary scene, but also that London culinary scene. And it's been a story of what it means to follow your dreams and make them very real. And we'll have more of the hopes and dreams from Great British Brands on these special episodes of Changemakers. Look forward to seeing you then.